Thank you. So I want to talk today about results I've been working on with my collaborators, Raimundo Oliveira from Brazil and Christian Moch from France, on the hard X-rays from gamma CAS. Gamma CAS is a star that is actually, as far as the X-ray community is concerned, the odd man out among BE X-ray stars. And I'll telegraph my conclusion right now by saying that we believe that the hard X-rays, which are anomalous, come from the BE star itself in a very near vicinity. So let me start by going through some of the important optical characteristics. The optical spectrum is that of a B0.5 class 4 star. It has very broad lines, probably critically rotating, or very nearly so. It has a emission, strong emission, continuum emission in the IR, and of course in the H-alpha lines and yellow-red iron 2 lines. Gamma CAS is now known as a prototype of a small group of classic hard X-ray emitting stars. And what we know about them so far is that they seem to be old, and at least three of them are probably blue stragglers. As Gail and John said yesterday, we know from interferometry that the star disk gives us an inclination that is intermediate. From 15 years of APT, robotic telescope photometry, and the Johnson B&V filter, we know that we have a robust signature that we attribute to rotation to a little more than 1.2 days. And also, various radial velocity studies are all in nice agreement. The star is in a binary. It has a 203-day orbit, and it has a circular, virtually no eccentricity. Very little is known about the status of the secondary star. Now, what is novel about the spectrum of this star and one other star in this group is the presence of what are called migrating subfeatures running red, blue to red through the line profiles. And I want to show you an example of this. This is taken from a big campaign we did in 1996 from the Hubble GHRS instrument, high-resolution spectrograph in the ultraviolet, simultaneous with an X-ray satellite. And these are the grayscales for 21 hours of continuous observations. And what you see here are these gray, wispy striations running blue to red, left from right, through the line profile. These are the migrating subfeatures. And they're wispy, they're short-lived things, but what's really important here is that they have a rapid acceleration through the line profile, almost 100 kilometers per second squared. And so if you ascribe these features to structures that were rotationally advected, then the star would have to be rotating at a supercritical rate, and it clearly cannot. I'll come back to this point in a moment. The X-ray characteristics are as follows. The X-ray spectrum can be decomposed to three or four components of optically thin thermal emitting plasma. The hottest component is the dominant one, contributes virtually all the continuum light. It has a temperature of about 160 million degrees. So even by X-ray BE standards, that's very high and fairly unusual. We now know that the X-ray light curve can be variable on a variety of distinct timescales. First, through rapid ubiquitous shots lasting a few seconds up to a minute, through what I call undulations ranging from 1 to a few hours, long cycles averaging about 70 days, and finally, episodic variations in the soft X-rays, which appear to be related to the optical BE outbursts. And I want to discuss each of these. Here are some of the segments of the all X-ray light curve during the 1996 campaign. And I just want to confine my attention here to these little short spikes that you see. These have very short decay times, just a few seconds. And if you use simple plasma cooling arguments, this suggests necessarily that the emission occurs in a high density regime, at least 10 to the 14th particles per cubic centimeter. In other words, a photospheric regime. The next slide, if I can find the cursor here, is a superposition of two light curves, still taken from that 1996 campaign. These dots are the X-ray observations, once again, 16-second averages, and actually all the scatter that you see is due to the shots or the flares, not the errors in the observations, which are quite a bit smaller. We were able to collapse part of the UV spectra to form a quasi-UV continuum, and this continuum is shown here, except I've inverted it, because you see there are undulations in the X-rays here, and they correspond to two dips in the light curve, about a 1% each. Those dips, by the way, evolve on too short a time scale for them to be associated with rotational advection once again. So they are necessarily due to translucent clouds forced into co-rotation over the star's surface. I want to jump now to some of the optical results from the APT results, actually 17 years of monitoring the star on every clear night in southern Arizona. The light curve is dominated by a 2 or 3% variation in any one season, and you can generally fit a sine curve through it with a period of anywhere between 55 to 91 days. We call it a 70-day long period. And you can see this in the other seasons in these smaller panels over here, too. These are very fragile variations. They do not repeat either in amplitude or period length. They evolve, and that's why we call them long cycles rather than periods. The takeaway from this slide, which you actually can't see in this slide, is this, that the V amplitude in these variations is always larger than the B filter amplitude. And this suggests that these are reddish variations, which are caused in a medium that's cooler than the BE star. In other words, the BE disk. And to show this a little more clearly, here are two seasons of bend APT data where we fit a modified sine curve with a slight DC component to it. And during this same time, we were awarded six observations from the Rossi XTE satellite, once again, each 27 hours long. So we just took the means and we discovered that they varied. And when we collapse the sine curve here to be a flat sine curve and just let the amplitude vary to fit the data, we get a really nice fit. So it seems that from this early exploration that we see X-ray optical cycles as well. And notice that there was no phase lag. My collaborator, Mick Christian Much, said, that's nice. But do we really want to see that much from six observations? So he took the APT data, recomputed the 70-day-ish cycle lengths for each of the 15 years, and then he did the same for archival data from all-sky monitoring X-ray experiments from RXDE and also the International Space Station MAXI experiment. In each case, he determined the amplitude. And for a couple of years here, this pink striation that you see up here is his result. This is frequency. This is a 70-day period running with time. And you see it agrees nicely with the 70-day period that he finds from the APT data. You even see the harmonics at 35 days. Well, he took the amplitude for each year from APT and the two X-ray experiments and converted them to luminosity, to power, in CGS units. And here are the results, annualized 1 point for each year. And you see a really nice correlation between the X-ray amplitude and the power and the optical in both, in two independent X-ray experiments. So you can say for the first time that we have a definitive conclusion that the long cycles coincide both in the law and the optical and X-ray, meaning that the conditions in the disk somehow mediate the variations in the X-rays. Also, I wanted to talk to you for a moment just about an episode, an outburst that happened in 2010. Gamma Cass underwent an outburst in the summer and fall of 2010. And this was most fortunate because we also had asked for four observations of the XMM satellite spaced a few weeks apart, and unbeknownst to us at the time, of course. And during the outburst, we could see H-alpha growing. We could see the star brightening in the photometry and the color reddening. And this is a B minus V color that reflects that here. At the same time, the soft X-rays were diminishing as this outburst progressed. And that's because of intervening column density, photoelectric absorption of the soft X-rays. And you can parameterize that by a column density expressed in the units of particles per square centimeter. And you see those four points here, 1, 2, 3, 4, as the outburst continued. And so you see a correlation here between the column length and the reddening. And that same correlation held the decade before, and we had not been able to understand that. The takeaway from this is the important point that we're looking through a column of absorbers to the hard X-ray source. And what is this column? It's the outgassing from the BE star. So the X-rays have to be coming from pretty close to the BE star in order for this effect to occur. Finally, I want to show a periodogram here of the APT data for the first several years. Here is the 1.2 rotational modulation period I promised you. Here is a comparison just observing window. Here is a waveform for a few nights of consecutive observations, intensive observations. What we did here was we took the period here and we just used that to fit each time, each year's data, B and V, independently. Here are the amplitudes that derive from that exercise. And you see they're pretty constant of 5 or 6 magnitudes. And then suddenly in 2004, they drop. They drop about to the level of detectability. So had we started this program several years later, we might not have been able to see that signature at all. And perhaps I suggest this might be why one reason why Coralie and Greg have not been able to see a magnetic signature. The other reason, of course, is I think it's a small-scale activity, small-scale configurations. Here are the conclusions, just to sum up. The hard X-rays are emitted in high-density medium. That comes from the shots. We're looking through and not cooling a flowing column through the BE outburst to the hard X-ray source. Has to be the BE star itself or something very close by. The long cycle variations are mediated by conditions, changing conditions in the BE disk. And finally, we see no delay in the X-ray response behind the UV changes over a few hours or the optical cycles. And this argues that the X-ray production does not arise from particles migrating from the BE star over to an accreting companion. In other words, it supports these other conclusions. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to see my talk.
You're welcome, Brian. Anyway, so we have questions, Ruby.
About the rotation, this period, you see. The rotation as such is just a clock. In order to make it show up in the data, you need a mechanism that translates the clock into an observable. What would that be in that case?
You're asking what is causing the magnetic signature? Signature?
You have the 1.22 day, and you say it's rotation.
Yes.
But, I mean, every star rotates.
Yes.
But you, in order to show it up in the data, in the light curve, you need something that...
Sometimes a star is bright and sometimes a star is faint. That's what we're saying, yes.
Yes. And you see that...
And it's a gray... And I should tell you that the color is gray. You get the same amplitude in the B and the V.
Yeah, but what I'm asking is, what is the physical mechanism that makes the rotation show up in the light curve? Is it a spot? Is it a magnetic...
I'll tell you what I believe, and it's speculative. I believe that we're looking at something like a faculty. You know, as you know, in BP stars, you see, with a magnetic spot, you see something that it's faint there, and that's because of the boundary metallic absorption ages. In O stars, apparently, magnetic spots show up as bright. Gamma Cassis is right in between, so I really don't know. My guess is it's like the O stars, but I'm not sure that I really know that. In fact, I'm sure I don't know.
so just before I get to my question, the mechanisms that produce... So you just talked about two mechanisms, the bright spots in O stars versus fainter spots in B stars, but the mechanisms are totally different. One's an opacity effect. The other is a faculty effect.
Yeah.
Magnetic stabilization effect. So I'm not sure you can make a comparison. So my question.
Well, we were just talking about phenomenology, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I guess the point is that there are ways that magnetic fields could create surface contrast variations.
Yes.
So my question is, and I really apologize if you mention this. Consider the companion is a 0.8 solar mass.
That's what we find from the radial velocity curve, yeah.
Right. It's likely to be premium sequence star?
I am prejudiced by the fact that some of these stars are blue stragglers in the class. For Gamma Cassis, we don't know that other than it's an old star. My guess, I used to think this might be a lower main sequence star, as I think you're suggesting. I'm wondering now whether this could be an unseen SDO star or something like that, which has previously spun the star up through mass transfer. The only problem with that explanation is we don't know if this can occur in stars that are not this widely spaced or not now. So that's a speculation.
But nevertheless, the companion is in the aperture when you're
Oh yeah! Oh yeah!
So is there
the companion is inert now.
Is there a killer piece of evidence that tells us that the X-rays aren't coming from the companion?
If you believe one of my first plots that shows the association of those UV dips with the X-ray undulations, that's about as close to killer as I can get, because the UV is all coming from the BE star. You don't see it infuse. For example, you don't see a faint companion in the far ultraviolet. And people have looked, as you know very well, for these companions in the far ultraviolet and don't see them, including Gamma Cassis.
Okay, well, let's thank Myra again for a very interesting